Inoho, please be seated. Commissioner.
So I hope this will be a relatively simple question. It's earlier on you referred to a permitted activity rule for the discharge of water from the dam. And you said that in terms of the Falls Dam, it wasn't proposed to reapply for what had been authorised under a deemed permit. So I just wondered if you could take me to that permitted activity that you're referring to. Somewhere there's a copy of the water plan.
I have it.
Thank you, Mr. Page.
Tab 1, volume 1.
Thank you.
I believe it's rule 12B110.
Well, perhaps if you could find it, and then you can tell us what the page is, and that'll make life simpler.
CB208 in the top corner.
CB208. And the rule number?
12B110.
So this refers to rule 13.2.1.3. How does that fit into it?
Could you say that again, sorry, Commissioner?
Well, I'm just looking at the rule, and the third line down refers to something, a dam that is not permitted by rule 13.2.1.3. So I just wondered what that rule said.
I'd have to check that rule, sorry.
Yep.
Well, just take time. I just want to be clear about this.
I believe that relates to the construction of a dam, but that's just in my notes, so I'll just go to that rule and confirm that. That rule is on CB234. And it's a permitted activity rule for the construction of a dam, or the erection and placement of any structure for the damming of water that is fixed in or on the bed of a lake, any lake or river, is a permitted activity.
So this one takes us somewhere else as well, doesn't it?
It does. I believe 12.3.2.1 is the permitted activity rule for the damming of water.
So which page is that one on?
12321 is CB196.
Sorry, what was that again?
CB196.
196. So there's a whole lot of things that come into this, aren't there? So have you worked your way through all of those?
In terms of what?
Well, in terms of trying to work out whether what you're suggesting in terms of Falls Dam is a permitted activity.
It's not a permitted activity. This upstream catchment is larger than 50 hectares. It certainly is higher than 3 metres, and it's got I think it's 10 cubic.
Right, okay.
So, yeah, magnitude's larger than what's permitted.
Right. So, going back the other way then, what does that mean under the permitted activity rule that you drew to my attention originally?
The existing structure is a permitted activity by way of being lawfully established. So it was established subject to a dam licence under the Mining Act, so it was lawfully established.
Okay, which so makes just it a, which take make me back to the rule again, sorry, the original one.
12B110.
Oh, sorry, that's the discharge. So the original rule referenced 13213, which is the rule for the erection or placement of structures as it being a permitted activity. And to be a permitted activity under 13213, you have to be a permitted activity under 12321. And Falls Dam isn't a permitted activity?
No, I'm asking you the questions in terms of how these rules work in relation to Falls Dam.
Well, Falls Dam is an existing structure.
Right.
And existing structures are permitted activities under 13111. So it's a separate rule. So I think these rules are sort of tailored towards the construction of new dams, whereas Falls Dam is permitted by way of a separate rule, being 13111. Shall I give you track that one down and give you the page reference?
Well, I'm wondering how helpful any of this is. I thought this might have been quite readily addressed in the light of your answer to the question earlier, but I think we can probably leave it and I could work my way through this in my own time if I feel the need to, because I would need to do that to be satisfied on it if I need to be. So I think I'll leave it at that.
All right, I've got no questions. Any questions? questions?
No, thank you.
Anything arising from the court's questions? All right, well, thank you very much for your evidence. Thank you.
Thanks.
That actually concludes your case, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yep.
I think our evidence is now done.
Yes. A little cheer.
You will get a sense that my body language isn't all that confident about that, but but we'll have to see.
Right.
Anyway, that's what we intend to call.
Okay, very good. So thank you very much, Mr. Page. And I guess we'll see you later.
Well.
Right. So I think, Ms. Irving, we're back in your hands now.
Yeah. So I'm now going to call Benji Patterson.
Yep. And if it just bear with me. Did you say, sorry, which witness?
Benjamin Patterson.
Patterson. Okay, just bear with me if I find the relevant documents.
An affirmation, thanks.
Do you solemnly sincerely and truly declare and agree that the evidence you give should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Mr. Patterson, is your full name Benjamin Robert Patterson?
It is.
And you are a self-employed economist specialising in regional economics?
Yes, that's correct.
And you have prepared a brief of evidence dated 3rd February 2021?
Yes, that's correct.
Are there any amendments that you wish to make to that brief of evidence at all?
None that I'm aware of.
On that basis, can you please confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
I can confirm that.
Thank you. Now, I don't have any further questions for you, so I'll leave you in the hands of my friends in the court.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bridget. Ms. Irwin.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I want to start somewhere towards the end of your evidence on page 9. And there you'll see a heading, Risks to Wellbeing.
Yes.
When you are giving evidence under this heading, are you giving evidence in relation to economic well-being or something else?
Economic and social well-being, just to clarify. So I've primarily been talking about employment opportunities within that section, and employment opportunities can be considered to fall under economic well-being as well as social well-being.
What do you understand Plan Change 7 is seeking to achieve?
To my understanding, it's seeking to implement an interim water regime until the new regional water plan is operative.
And when you were thinking about your evidence, did you have it in mind that there could be significant changes to the flow and allocation regime for water as a result of the planning process to come in the future?
My evidence was primarily to provide context to the importance of of water to agriculture and how important agriculture was to the Central Otago economy and the implications of that economic activity for employment opportunities across the district, both in those rural areas and into the urban environment from it flowing on into and from spending from farms flowing into the local economy and wages from those that work in farms flowing into the local economy.
Now, at your paragraph 41, you go on to discuss the risks as you see them posed to the well-being of employees in the agricultural sector as a result of Plan Change 7. And there you refer to it undermining the case for investments, which could lead to new employment opportunities. You also note it may induce... It may preclude perhaps productivity improvements which allow for higher wages. So those are the two strands in respect of your evidence. So when you think about the risks that Plan Change 7 poses, what did you have in mind? What is the risk that you have in mind that Plan Change 7 is creating?
Well, the short-term nature of the consents, it creates uncertainty, and when you're investing in the future, you are ultimately trying to earn a return, either to get that return on your existing equity or to service debt obligations. And any uncertainty that you have regarding the duration that you can get that yield is going to affect the types of investment opportunities that you are going to entertain.
When you think about that risk in this context, is that risk perhaps described as the certainty around the long-term access to water?
In this situation, I was referring primarily to the duration.
So when you think about Plan Change 7 and what it's seeking to do, which is to put in place an interim framework until the long-term availability of water can be better understood, doesn't that risk exist irrespective of what Plan Change 7 is doing or seeking to achieve?
So what I was trying to highlight there was that when you have these periods of uncertainty, that if it undermines the case for new investment, and whether that's investment in new infrastructure or upgrading existing, that the people ultimately affected are people that earn a living from that. And the point of that paragraph was to highlight that people that work in those businesses, on average, they earn less money than in other parts of the local economy, so that these are quite financially vulnerable people, these employees.
Don't those effects arise irrespective of Plan Change 7, though, given the inherent uncertainty with respect to the long-term access to water in the Otago region?
There's different levels of uncertainty. You can get uncertainty regarding, for example, the amount of water that you can take, but also there's uncertainty regarding the duration. And so what I was trying to get at there was that if you have an increased level of certainty over the duration, that's at least cleared up one angle and you're in the tent, so to speak.
Is your understanding of a long-term permit then predicated on an assumption that a long-term permit can't be changed during the duration of that permit?
Sorry, could you please rephrase that for me?
When you're thinking about the benefit of a long-term permit, is it your understanding that the terms of that permit can't be changed throughout the life of the permit?
No, that's not my understanding.
So is your understanding that in the context of a water permit, the allocation in a permit might be changed throughout the course of the permit?
I'm aware that that could be a possibility.
And insofar as there are water short catchments in the Otago region, then that possibility or the possibility of changes to the terms of consents exists?
Yes, that's a possibility.
And so when you think about certainty, a long-term permit doesn't actually bring long-term certainty in terms of access to the water resource, does it?
It brings a level of, in this, to my knowledge, what I was trying to get at there was that if you have a horizon, for example, less than 6 years, you're going to know that in no shape of the world could you earn a sufficient payback on your investment. So you wouldn't be, you'd be very hesitant to put it in because you'd be gambling as to whether you could, renew a permit for a longer duration. If you had a longer duration, at least you know that, in theory, you have that time frame, although within that time frame, perhaps the water settings that you are permitted to take, you know, could be adjusted, but you would have at least clarified that the duration.
When you think about Plan Change 7, if one of its purposes is to discourage investment in irrigation infrastructure over the next six-year period through imposing short-term permits, would you accept that it is achieving that effect?
When taken narrowly, it would discourage that investment.
And when you think about the level of investment required for irrigation infrastructure, that's typically significant capital investment?
Yes, that's correct.
And when you think about the future risk associated with uncertainty about access to water, isn't it better to signal now, before those investments are made, that there may be insufficient water available in the future with respect to the use of that infrastructure?
Yeah, this doesn't speak to the rationing of water within the existing take. So there are situations where you might understand that water is going to be more scarce in the future, but if you are a more productive use of it, you may be able to more efficiently apply it than other types of water users in a catchment.
If you're more productive, you can...
Well, I guess to illustrate my example there, there's different types of land use which might be able to achieve a much more productive return per hectare than others. And so by limiting their investment, you're hamstringing the potential economic benefits that could come from those investments that might be more productive from an economic perspective than existing ones that are in the catchment.
Do you have in mind any examples in terms of those more productive land uses?
So for example, from my discussions with agribusiness consultants, they've told me that cherry orchards, for example, can be in the order of easily 10 to 12 times the gross yields of, for example, dairying.
And there's significant capital cost or investment required to undertake such a conversion?
Yes, there is.
And the time required to repay or to service debt in relation to the capital investment would be longer than a six-year term or six-year horizon?
That's my understanding from when you put the infrastructure in the ground and plant the trees. You're not anticipating getting any sort of material cash return that can go into paying down debt until towards the end of that horizon.
And the long-term security of access to water would be an important consideration in deciding whether to undertake such a conversion, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Now, your paragraph 43, you refer to, in your words, the backward-looking nature of the proposed permissible water takes that might prevent land that has already been planted from being irrigated and harvested in the short term.
Yes.
Now, I'm not sure whether you've been following along with the hearing in relation to the development of the plan change to respond to this issue. Have you been keeping up with the shift in terms of stranded assets?
Could you please enlighten me, perhaps?
Right, so the issue has arisen in evidence in terms of the notified version of Plan Change 7, which had restrictions on not expanding an irrigable area beyond that irrigated in 2017. Mm-hmm. So the planners have recommended that period of time is expanded, so it's between September 2017 and June, I think, 2020, to seek to address the issue over people having invested by, for example, planting and then irrigating within that period. The other matter which is being considered is a rule which might enable reconsenting of additional areas of irrigated land where irrigation main lines had been installed before the plan was notified. Are you aware of those changes, or do you have an understanding of those changes and what they're seeking to achieve?
I was aware of the first one that you talked about, but which didn't, in my opinion, adequately address what I had referred to in 43. The second one I was not aware of, but it does take some steps towards what I've referred to there from what you've just said.
So having listened to what I've just said, do you still perceive there to be a gap in terms of the historic investments made?
There would be one area that I'd be concerned about, and that's it's my understanding with plantings that it's not simply a matter of having the irrigation infrastructure in the ground, that at different stages as they grow and develop and then move into harvest, that there's different levels of water demand. So some of these plants, they may already be taking a certain level of water, but when they reach maturity, which might be in 1, 2, 3 years' time, that they'll have additional water requirements than what currently is being used in terms of the volume. So in effect, if those weren't considered as part of it, it may impede the commercial harvesting of these crops that are already in the ground.
But wouldn't the investment decisions in terms of those plantings have been made based on an understanding of water availability at the time?
When the decision to invest would have been made based on water availability, what the investor's perception was of water availability. But I would like to add there that some of these lead times in investment can be very, very long. So, you could easily be some of these crops that could have been 5, 6, years ago or so that these investments were being planned and implemented.
And in your experience, should the risk of long-term water availability be taken into account when those investment decisions are being made?
Well, risk, you know, when you're making any sort of forward-looking decision, you do need to take into consideration risks, both those that are immediately apparent from current regulatory regimes, as well as any forward planning does consider what it thinks might occur. But there's a level of uncertainty that persists in that.
In your evidence, have you assessed the economic effect of environmental degradation continuing into the long term, if long term permits are to be granted?
There were no environmental considerations within the scope of the evidence I provided.
Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you.
A re-examination.
Your Honour.
So as a tool, a policy discouraging investment, moving into an uncertain future in terms of access to water, and here I'm using water as a resource, it seems to be water as a commodity is how it's viewed by many in the primary sector. So as a tool, continued access to the water resource, a policy which creates uncertainty around that access is effective or may be effective in terms of discouraging increased capital investment in infrastructure?
It certainly can be effective and discouraging, yes. Mm-hmm.
So some may continue to invest to improve productivity and improve efficiency on farm, notwithstanding uncertainties going future uncertainties under a land and water plan, a new land and water plan?
Yeah, it's not likely to discourage all, but it's certainly going to, people are going to need to factor in the return that it's providing them because the future's so much more uncertain, so they would expect to get a higher immediate return from their investment.
And that's in order to pay down debt to meet bank lending criteria or the lending criteria of other private sourced funds.
Yes, that and if it was your own equity to satisfy the returns that you're expecting to receive. Yeah.
And is the and you talk about the link between consent duration and paying down debt because a longer duration gives confidence. This is in your answers to Councillor's questions, because a longer duration gives confidence to gives confidence to the farmer that there is a period of time over which debt can be paid down, and that is so notwithstanding adjustment to the settings is what you called it, and I think there you're referring to the terms of or the conditions of a resource consent. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And I wonder whether in saying that, your assumption is that if those settings were to change and water availability was to become more constrained, you have assumed that the farmer may continue to take and use water without additional investment in irrigation infrastructure. And I wonder if that was your assumption, and here I have in mind the need to provide or increase on-farm storage and to move to more efficient irrigation systems if they've not already done so in order to make best use of now more limited water than previously was the case.
I wasn't precluding in that the possibility of further investment down the track, and indeed a lot of farmers that were looking towards the future now, they would be trying to predicate their investment on the idea that that water would be more scarce, because that's been well signalled.
But is the risk for Otago that a long-term consent will give farmers confidence to make capital investment in irrigation infrastructure, which is insufficient to meet a new regime under a new land and water plan to come? Isn't that the risk? And that they will have to further invest, and that they may or may not have equity or access to capital to be able to do so.
There's always a risk that the types of investment made don't long-term meet whatever future regulatory regime there is. But the point would be that investments that are made now by farmers, they could, you know, to the best of their current knowledge, you know, attempt to aim for some sort of, you know, reduction in the water that they're using. They'd be able to amortise it over a much longer period of time, their investment.
And if they can't, because they can't get access to capital or equity, then one of two consequences. One is economic hardship and or stranded assets in terms of the infrastructure that they have in place, but which cannot afford to change.
At a farm level, yes. At a community level, from an employment perspective, there's also foregoing the opportunities for productivity improvements. And if I may, I'd just like to talk about the relationship between productivity and wage growth. And typically, in economic theory, that's why productivity improvements are a factor that leads to wage growth over the long term. And employment in the agricultural sector in central Otago is very, very important part of the local economy. A lot of people rely on it, but at present they earn lower wages on average than people working in other industries. So my concern is that if some of these investments that can lead to higher productivity are put off, that can ultimately cause long-term problems for wage growth in the sector.
And so the future looks entirely unclear. You're nodding in agreement. Is that a yes for the record?
Sorry, yeah, that's a yes.
Because some now, and regardless of this plan change to come, but regardless of this plan change and the plan to come, will already be moving, or will continue to make that investment in order to increase productivity and make efficiency gains in terms of the water resource. So some are doing that now, regardless of this plan change, I think was something
yes,
that you
but
said.
Yeah, but also some of it would be towards, if there was a modal shift in farming systems, so if there was a farm that was wanting to switch into a different type of farming system than they had before, that's not something that might be entertained until this was cleared up.
So the first proposition is that some will continue with that investment regardless of this plan change or a future plan. I thought that's what the evidence was.
Well, there might be a minority of people,
but
a lot of investment would be put off because of the uncertainty, and some of that would be because the business owner wasn't prepared to take on the risk. But it could also be forced on them by their funding partners not being prepared to take on the risk because they weren't reassured that the cash flow was going to reliably be there to service the debt or other or whatever whatever other type of investment mechanism had occurred by the funder.
And others will be prepared to make that capital investment, provided there's a long-term consent, because they have a longer time to pay down that debt. And others, and if there is a modal change that you're talking about, or any change in a flow and allocation regime, yet others might then have to make further capital investment as a consequence of a plan to come, if they are able to, and they may not be.
Sorry, there's quite a few things in that.
You're dealing with a whole bunch of uncertainty, and I think, you know, it's your basic proposition that you should allow farmers to incur to make productivity increases and efficiency gains in terms of the use of water by improving their irrigation infrastructure ahead of those changes settings when the new land and water plan comes.
What I'd been trying to
say... Is that your basic proposition?
My basic proposition is that there's this period of uncertainty that will that will get in the way of a lot of that investment occurring. Mm. Some of which may actually enhance the ability to adhere to subsequent water plans as they come out, but some of it might also be improvements that have other benefits in the community. So I was talking about employment, better employment opportunities when I referred to that.
So is it that you can't, maybe it's beyond your brief to be able to talk about the consequences to people, that is individual farmers and community, if they are unable to respond to changes within their settings of their current irrigation infrastructure systems, should that be required under a land and water plan in the future?
Sorry, I didn't.
Your basic proposition is give them a long-term consent and they'll invest wisely. And what I'm asking you, is it not the case that they may invest wisely now but be required to invest again 6 years down the track? And some may not be able to do that. And some may face severe economic hardship as a consequence of being asked to do that.
Yeah, so my what I would be saying is that many people would be deferring investment while they wait.
So many people now will be deferring investment.
Yes.
Right.
If you are only able to get a six-year duration.
Yeah.
And because there's such long lead times in this investment until you can get a commercial yield, the ramifications of that period of uncertainty can persist for a lot longer period of time. And what I was trying to identify in my evidence was that this risk is not only borne by the capital owner,
but it's also by the
community.
So I've no issue with that, because I understand all of that. There isn't the risk that the regional council's endeavouring to deal with, and I'm not sure what your thoughts are about that, is that if you provide a long-term consent and people make investment decisions now on the basis of that duration and assumptions that they may be able to pay down that debt, that the settings of or underpinnings of those assumptions may change under a land and water plan, which may require, amongst other things, further capital investment.
That's certainly a risk.
And did you consider that risk and whether that should be... Yeah, did you consider that risk?
I didn't directly consider that risk in my brief of evidence.
But isn't it relevant to people and communities?
Well, in any decision that we make, we've always got to take into consideration a whole spectrum of risks.
Isn't that what the regional council's particularly concerned with? One of its concerns is economic hardship should the land and water plan change settings for the take and use of water, and the ability of the farming community to respond to those new settings if they have made capital investment decisions in the interim period. Isn't that what it's concerned about?
I'm not sure.
Okay. And you offer no comment on that?
I offered no comment on that, no.
All right, thank you. You have any questions?
No, I don't have any questions, thank you.
No? Okay, anything arising from the court's questions?
Not from me, no.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jennifer McGurr. Good afternoon, Ms. McGurr. Is your full name Jennifer Sonia McGurr?
It is.
And you are the Environmental Manager for Infrastructure at the Queenstown Lakes District Council?
I am.
You have prepared two briefs of evidence in relation to this case, the first being dated 4 February 2021, and a supplementary brief of evidence dated 11 May 2021.
That's correct.
Are there any amendments that you wish to make to either of those briefs of evidence?
No.
Can you please confirm for the court that they are true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
I can confirm that.
Thank you. I just have one question I wish to ask you. And it's in relation to how consenting risk is factored into the decisions councils may make about planning infrastructure. Are you able to elaborate on that at all?
Yes, I can. So I would say that the consenting risk for projects is considered at during a number of different stages. So when a need for a project is identified, we would then typically look at a number of different options to address that need. So for example, with the Luggett scheme, which is described in my evidence, there are a couple of different needs identified there. One is that we need to upgrade the supply to fully comply with the drinking water standards, and the other is to address constraints at the current site. So that project has been investigated, or options for that project have been investigated over a number of years, and during that process, the consentability of different options is weighed up, so it's definitely given consideration. So I do talk about that in my evidence, but the current option for the Luggett scheme is to install a new bore field and treatment plant in a different location in Luggett. And that particular option was chosen because it was likely to be more consentable based on the current regional plan framework and the known sort of allocation issues in that catchment and surrounding catchments.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Your Honour. Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I wanted to start with the Luggett scheme and the upgrades that you have described in your supplementary statement of evidence. And I'm interested to understand what information your council holds in relation to the various uses of water in relation to the Luggett scheme. Now, you've provided some information in your paragraph 14 as to the breakdown of properties taking water from that scheme. Now,
In terms of the way in which you've undertaken that record, you have simply followed the rating database, as I understand it?
That's correct.
Are the supplies of water to the various categories identified in your paragraph 14, are those metered supplies or are they unmetered?
They're a combination of metered and unmetered, largely unmetered, as is the case with most of the connections in our district.
So when you think about the range of uses to which water is put in staying with the Luggett Township, is it fair to say the council doesn't actually know how much water is used for each of the different types of uses to which it is put?
I guess very simplistically, yes, because we don't meter each connection. So the information I have provided there is quite at a basic level, because it is simply identifying the number of properties, the number of different types of connections. I mean, and not having the metering data that, for example, Central Otago District Council Ms Muir presented on Tuesday, we don't have that level of resolution. We do perform analysis in terms of connections, number of connections, and the population of Luggett, and therefore what is the average use per person or per connection per day.
When you've referred at your paragraph 14 to the supply to rural properties, so 21.1%, are there any restrictions placed in terms of the use to which that water can be put?
I would say not purely in terms of the use, but in terms of the volumes. So the intention, Luggett is an interesting scheme because most of our schemes are largely urban, and Luggett, even though actually the rural or lifestyle component is not very large, this is probably one of our schemes which has the larger component of rural. Sorry, could you repeat your question? I've just lost my train of thought.
It was about restrictions on the use to which the water was put.
So what I was alluding to there is that, so the intention is largely to provide only water supply for sort of urban use, not for larger volumes for rural use. So with these kinds of schemes, and you can see from one of my appendices, there's an area of the scheme which is on a restrictor. It's called a restricted supply scheme. We have a small number of those in our district. And so they are supplied water largely in a different mannerism to the urban schemes, which are on demand. So you turn your tap on and the water flows, whereas these ones, I think I described in my evidence, but they have a restrictor on them, so they can only obtain a certain amount per day.
But, and then as I understand your evidence, that water is stored on the individual sites and then used as the occupancy fit.
That is correct, and from my understanding, a number of those rural or lifestyle properties in Luggett are also connected to a private scheme for irrigation purposes. So the intention of the council reticulated supply is largely for potable household purposes, and they may be obtaining water from another scheme for other purposes. In saying that, those rural, that percentage of rural properties, they're not large tracts of rural land. I had a look on our GIS database, and they typically around 1 acre in size and smaller. So they're just residential lifestyle properties.
And you also note that water is also used for commercial and other uses, again tagged to the database. Does the council have any understanding of the quantities or volumes of water used for commercial purposes?
I don't have that information to hand. There would be limited information, I would say, in terms, because that would be metering information.
Now, your paragraph 18, you have explained the current project in relation to upgrading the Luggett community water supply. And I'm interested to understand the sequencing of the work required for this type of an upgrade, and I'm interested to understand when the resource consent to take water is applied for in terms of that sequence. So are you able to step through the way in which, in the Luggett context, the sequencing works?
Yes, so as I described before, usually there's an options assessment made and then a preferred option is chosen. That's very simplified. And then there's usually preliminary sort of investigations undertaken, physical on-site works to confirm assumptions around whether the water is available, land acquisition and that kind of thing to actually put the treatment plant in. And potential consentability or planning is usually considered in those early stages as well, as I described, even in those early options assessments. We also would typically engage with the ORC early on in terms of pre-application or even informal discussion. So I'm certain that we have as well for this Luggett scheme, though noting that was probably a couple of years ago because these things can take quite some time. But the consent is not usually applied for until, well, I would say actually still quite early on, once a solution is identified and confirmed. So with Luggett, we are currently doing these investigations, and if they are successful, we will look at design of the infrastructure required, and once we have landed on enough, and basically once we have enough information to put a consent application forward, then that would be lodged.
So you're consenting at that point the system that you've already established through the investigation part of the process. Perhaps put a different way, once the consent's been obtained, there's not further development and investigation work underpinning that consent. It's once those works have been undertaken.
Sorry, could you repeat that?
So when you think about the investigation work that's currently underway, the resource consent for the supply is not sought until the investigation work's complete?
Yes, that would be correct, because there is a minimum sort of amount of information that we would need to be able to put an application forward.
And stepping through then, once that information's understood and you understand what the treatment plant and the location of bores, etc., looks like, it's at that point you'd obtain the resource consent for access to the water?
That's correct.
And the subsequent construction of the plants would then follow?
Yes.
So when you're thinking about that subsequent construction of the treatment plant, for example, further testing or investigation as to the suitability of the resource, that step's already happened, hasn't it?
I would say so, yes.
I want to move on to the second example that you discussed in your evidence in relation to Wanaka and Albert Town. And at paragraph 25, you provide a breakdown as to the rating database in terms of properties that might be supplied. So same methodology there as you had followed for Luggett?
That's correct.
And again, no understanding of actual volumes taken for those uses, as in those takes aren't metered?
That's correct.
And then you go on to describe some future works that might need to be taken in relation to upgrading this scheme, and you address that at your paragraph 27. And there you discuss that two options are being considered in terms of the upgrade with respect to the intake infrastructure.
That's correct.
Now, have I understood correctly that there are no changes in the source in terms of the water to be taken?
That is correct. It will just be a different intake location at the same source.
So
the intakes from Lake Wanaka, and the proposal would be for a secondary intake also from Lake Wanaka, but at a slightly different location.
Thank you.
And insofar as the intake location could be adjusted, noting it's from the same source, if that could occur through a variation to the existing water permit, then Plan Change 7 wouldn't create any difficulties with respect to that upgrade.
That's correct. It's not always clear in these situations whether a variation would be acceptable or whether it would require a new permit. For example, with the Luggett scheme, I explain in my evidence we had previously, only recently obtained a new permit for Luggett because we had to drill a new bore nearby, so, and we had to go through a new consenting process for that.
A different source there, groundwater compared to lake water, though.
Between Luggett and Wanaka, yes.
In the final part of your evidence, you respond to some questions in relation to infrastructure readiness.
Yes.
And you note that the 2021 HBA will reassess plan-enabled and infrastructure-ready development capacity.
That's correct.
When you think about infrastructure-ready development capacity, do you understand that to include allocation of fresh water, or are you referring to the infrastructure required to take water in this context?
Well, I suppose it is in terms of the infrastructure required, though the availability of water is very closely linked to that. I wouldn't say that something is infrastructure ready if the infrastructure was there but there was no water available.
So when you carried out, or were you involved in the 2017 HBA assessment?
Not directly, no.
So insofar as that assessment concluded that all zoned land was able to be serviced by development infrastructure in the short, medium and long term, did you have an understanding that water allocation was available in each of the short, medium and long term with respect to that assessment?
I couldn't speak to that because I wasn't involved in drafting it. No.
Okay, thank you. Those are my questions.
All right. Re-examination?
No, I don't think so.
You got any questions?
Oh, I don't have any questions, thank you.
No questions, thank you.
All right, thank you. And I have no questions, so thank you very much for your evidence.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, but you'd like lunch?
Well, I'm just, I don't know. I don't mind either way, but if he's going to be in the witness box for some time, maybe that would be...
He might be.
Mr. Moore may have a view.
Mr. Moore may have a view. And anyway,
he surely doesn't have any more questions for Mr. Toos.
Oh, since he's taken the trouble to come back, I had prepared some questions.
In a comprehensive way. Yeah.
My suspicion is I wouldn't be finished by 12:45.
Well, theoretically speaking, we're meant to be taking lunch at 12:30, so...
Oh, let's take lunch.
OK, let's take lunch. We're taking lunch. And we're back here at 1:30. All right. All rise.